From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is a special Halloween episode of On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This year marks, with blood and guts, the 50th anniversary of Night of the Living Dead, the zombie flick that gave new life to the undead and to a pop culture genre.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Zombies first staggered onto the screen in the 1930s, capturing the cultural anxiety of the Great Depression. Since then, they have been mainstays in film and television. But the history of zombies far outpaces the popularity of The Walking Dead. It's grounded in dynamics of race and gender and power. Here with a primer on this history is Sarah Juliet Lauro, assistant professor of hemispheric literature at the University of Tampa, as well as an author. Her book, The Transatlantic Zombie, Slavery, Rebellion, and Living Death, explores the transatlantic slave trade as the historical center of the zombie narrative. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Well, that is such a big title, and I found researching this topic so much zombie-related academic literature. Your book, of course, also Race, Oppression, and the Zombie, essays on cross-cultural appropriations of the Caribbean tradition, zombies, a cultural history, Generation Zombie. The list goes on and on. How did this pop culture phenomenon become a college course or series of courses in zombie studies?
Well, I think that my interest in the zombie really came about after I started seeing this incredible surge of popularity in terms of zombies. And I'll just give you what I think is the most signal example was the zombie walk phenomenon that started around 2003 and really just caught on like wildfire and started to dwindle around 2008. But it was the phenomenon where people were dressing up as zombies and showing up in public, often completely unrelated to Halloween, in May and June, all year round. And I thought, what is happening? Why is this imagery resonating so deeply with people right now? So I think that the other academics who studied zombies like me sort of felt that through popular culture, people have a means of speaking in a kind of different language, a language of symbols, and that something was happening at the turn of the millennium, and we followed suit to study that phenomenon.
What do you think it was? I mean, I know you've done a lot of study on it, and it may not be easy to summarize, but your headline thought on that.
I think I can summarize it, actually. So there are a lot of other scholars, and everybody has an opinion. Some people say they think it was deeply related to 9/11. Other people, a very popular idea is that it has to do with economic downturn, especially because, as you noted, the first surge of zombie popularity occurred in the 1930s with the Great Depression. It could be something more amorphous, like the change from the millennium and just a general sort of dissatisfaction with the way that humanity was headed. I personally think that there was a lot of different things happening at the time, and that generally we gravitate towards the imagery of the zombie when we feel disempowered. If you just think at its most simple form of the zombie as a living corpse, because as I study especially, before it became violent, before it became a cannibal, before it became contagious, the zombie was really just a dead body that had been raised from its grave by a witch doctor. And so that is just such a symbol of disempowerment. It's life continuing to slog on in a really disempowered state. So I think we as a culture, and I would say, you know, it really was a worldwide phenomenon, so it must have just been something in the air throughout the globe, felt sort of that the people in power weren't listening to us, and that's why the zombie was so popular at that time.
What were those early zombie films in the 1930s?
So that first wave of zombie film really came out of, historically, the U.S. occupation of Haiti. There was a political occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. And as a result of that long period when we had troops overseas, a lot of people were coming back from Haiti and writing memoirs, telling stories of dead men working in the cane fields, as William Seabrook wrote in his book, The Magic Island.
Whoa, and that's chilling.
Yes, it is chilling. And that's exactly the reaction that Hollywood directors had when they sort of started coming across this material, whether it be in a sort of pseudo-anthropological text like Seabrook's or Zora Neale Hurston's, or whether it was in just these autobiographies from Marines who had been stationed in Haiti. And the idea that that there was this folkloric figure of a living corpse in Haiti was something that immediately Hollywood just grabbed onto and said, oh, this is something, you know, we can make good with. This is chilling, exactly as you said. So that first wave of zombie cinema still very much keeps to the original mythology. There's still voodoo implied. There are the corpses that are raised are very powerless. They might, in some of the films, turn against their master, but they tend to be feeble. They're a far cry from the millennial zombies that we have that are fast, that are scary, that are tearing flesh away with their teeth. So the whole story of how we get from that first disempowered zombie in 1934 to the truly terrifying zombie that we're haunted by today is a very big subject, too much to tackle in this conversation, but it is something that I've written about in my book and that other people, as you noted, have written about as well.
So it really caught on during a deeply anxious time in American history, the Great Depression, we both noted, where people weren't really sure where their next meal was coming from and the entire country's future was in flux. So besides being this creepy folkloric figure brought from elsewhere, what did zombies do to kind of capture that cultural feeling of anxiety?
Well, I think the directors were the first zombie film directors were very savvy and saw the resonance that this figure could have. So although the original iconography in those books would depict zombies working in the cane fields, as I said, agricultural zombies. They transpose them, even in the very first film, White Zombie, you see zombies working in a factory. It's a sugarcane mill, but the imagery that would resound with an audience in the United States who might feel like, oh, I see a similarity here between the way I feel when I'm on that factory line doing the same mechanized gesture over and over, and these zombies who are laboring beyond their own death.
What did they look like?
So the zombies in the original films often were dark-skinned because many of them were set in Caribbean islands. But one thing that I've been especially interested in picking apart is the way that we whitewashed zombies very early on. Those early zombie films were always usually about the fear that a white person would be zombified. Zombies were just a phenomenon occurring on this Caribbean island, and you have white protagonists who end up stumbling across this phenomenon, but then there's a threat to whiteness and often white femininity, where a white woman is in danger of becoming a zombie, and so that will be the central plot around which those early films pivot. So the other thing that I find fascinating is that those early zombie films also quickly begin to decolorize not just the victims of zombification, but the perpetrators. Sometimes this is very difficult to see because the zombie masters, it's sort of unspecified whether they're meant to be a Creole, which was a person of European descent who grew up in the Caribbean, or whether they're meant to be European. But increasingly what you see is white people who have taken command of black magic, and they are the true villains. So I like to say you have this sort of, it would be funny if it weren't also kind of sinister, you have us take a mythology that was from Haiti that was deeply about the transatlantic slave trade and the people's struggle against slavery and for freedom, and you have it become almost immediately in its uptake into American cinema about the threat against white people by other white people and with white people coming in to save the day.
We're speaking with Sarah Juliette Lauro. She is our resident zombie scholar today on this Halloween special episode of On Second Thought, learning about the deep cultural and historic roots of the zombie, which has become so popular in our culture. Well, I'd like to hear more about that idea of the transatlantic slave trade. The zombie lore, which started in Haiti, was that carried from African belief systems or myths?
I believe so. So this is all This is one theory because we don't have the kind of paper trail because this is an oral history. But in my book, I sort of expound upon my theory and tracing these breadcrumb trail back to the west coast of Africa. There, I found in a late 17th century text that was recording sailors' narratives as they returned from the west coast, sort of what would be the Angola and Congo region of Africa, recounting a mythology of soul capture, which to me is very similar to the zombie as it becomes. It's basically the idea that there are some witches or sorcerers who will steal your soul and force it to labor after death for eternity. This is exactly the form that we come to see the zombie take in Haiti. So my theory is that it was born out of probably not just that mythology alone, but kind of in the cauldron of the Caribbean and the slave trade, which brought together African people from, you know, various places on the continent. The mythology really solidified in the Caribbean around the time of the Haitian Revolution and then wasn't really transmitted outside of it until that first wave in the early 20th century.
You mentioned the concept of the witch doctor and the depiction of that in the early zombie films, controlling the zombies so their lives were not their own.
Zombies? Yes. They are my servants.
This soul killer takes men from their graves to be his slaves. His instruments of terror, and now this fiend plots to possess a woman.
But that shifted over the years. Why do you think that narrative thread got lost in the telling of this story?
I think it's one of the sort of the easiest things to see. On the one hand, I think it kind of merged with a Frankensteinian trope that was already really legible to film audiences. So in the witch doctor kind of becomes the mad scientist in a lot of films. And so you have a mad scientist raising the dead and they're zombie-like, or he's borrowing from voodoo mythology to raise the dead. And there's that's sort of one fork in the road. And then the other one is that around the time of the Cold War, when you have a large spate of movies in the 1950s that are sort of low-budget B-movie horror. And in that period, the zombie becomes very abstracted to a kind of it's not under the control of any one person, but it's an unintended consequence. It's some sort of fallout from a technological advancement. And I think that it's very obvious to see that that was about concern with technology and science, that somehow we as humans had overreached in terms of what we were capable of was sort of outpacing our moral development. I mean, that's pretty much articulated verbatim by a character in Ed Wood's film Plan 9 from Outer Space, where you have aliens raising the dead. So the zombie there becomes a little bit different. It's much more about space radiation. It's more about a kind of technology someone's developing to combat the Russians, as in a film like Astro Zombies. And it becomes more amorphous.
So zombies begin to mirror what is going on in our cultural cosmology, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they do.
And then later in the Cold War, George Romero's dead films, the genre begins in 1968 with Night of the Living Dead. And besides kind of creating a world building for the zombies, it's also a really interesting historical artifact because this was the same year Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, both assassinated, Civil Rights Act passed. And when the struggle for racial equality permeated conversations and thinking in America. So then you get a film in October, black protagonist who's protecting a terrified white woman from this plague of zombies.
If we have to, we can run in here and board up the doors. Won't be long before those things will be back pounding their way in here. They're afraid now.
And in the end, it is not the zombies that get him, but he's shot by a group of white men. Now, George Romero said Dwayne Jones, who played the lead, just happened to be the best actor. Do you think fans are wrong to make this into a commentary on race and equality?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think, if anything, that story just speaks volumes about the way that there isn't really an author, that popular cultural artifacts are something that they sort of – they almost speak through a person who's creating the text, that these things are all in the air. And almost – I like to say that George Romero was haunted by the zombie. He may not have been thinking when he made that film that it had anything to do with slavery. But I feel that the vibration was there. Obviously, he had seen those movies. He was tapping into the same kind of language in terms of revolution that the earlier zombie films were in tune with. And it's almost like it just came through over the airwaves. Whether or not he intentionally wanted the film to be political, it was obviously political, and that's why the film is so beloved. There were many zombie movies in the years before that that had similar aspects that were, I mean, obviously it's a wonderful, wonderful film, but it was the right time, it was the right place, it was the right ingredients to just be a political bombshell.
I'm speaking with Sarah Juliet Lauro. She's from the University of Tampa, and we're talking about the history of zombies. After the break, we'll talk more about her research and more about the significance of zombie culture in America today. This is On Second Thought, and a special Halloween episode. I'm Virginia Prescott with a special Halloween edition of On Second Thought. Up next, we're going to learn about a few Fox Theater visitors who never left. And hear some tall tales about UGA students who got adventurous and did not live to regret it. But first, we're continuing our conversation with Sarah Juliet Lauro from the University of Tampa about the origin of zombies. She is among a growing field, I will say, of zombie scholars and author of The Transatlantic Zombie, Slavery, Rebellion, and Living Death. There is, Sarah, a lot of debate about cultural appropriation and what belongs to whom? What kind of Halloween costumes can you wear? What are the dynamics of power involved in cultural borrowings? And you told us how the zombie story came about through slavery and colonial occupation. So does the zombie story help us understand or even complicate ideas about cultural appropriation?
It complicates them in a way that I feel is so revelatory and so important. And I'm really glad you asked that question. So when I was a young graduate student going to Haiti to write this book and excited to be in the culture that the zombie came from, that was basically my thesis for the book, was look at the way that Hollywood culturally appropriated this imagery, which is so important to you, and reshaped it and made it about ourselves. I was astonished by the reaction that I got from Haitians, and this has completely helped me to change my thinking about actually so many things. So here's what I learned in Haiti. Haitians said, "How dare you think that you culturally appropriated us? We have invaded you. We are so powerful that you couldn't help but be enchanted by our mythology." And I thought that was so incredible. And it just was a great reminder of the way that power never works one way. If you feel the need to culturally appropriate a symbol, it's because it has some kind of power for you.
It makes me think of how ethnocentric we are indeed, even about questions of appropriation. And the invasion idea is so big. Back in 2011, the CDC posted a series of articles called Preparedness 101, Zombie Apocalypse. And the person who wrote them, a Rear Admiral, Ali Khan, he was the deputy director of the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic, if I'm saying that properly, infectious diseases. So this guy knows something that we don't. How likely is a zombie outbreak?
I wouldn't put any money on it at Vegas.
Well, do you think that scientists have appropriated that part of popular culture, what, to communicate to the masses? Is that what it's about?
I think it's a convenient tool. I think that zombie preparedness is a good way to talk about preparedness for other things that might be too painful to actually think about, like a mass shooter. If we're kind of trying to look into the future and think what's going to happen now in the field of zombies, I wouldn't say that zombies are going to step off the silver screen and out of the television set and into our real lives. But I do try to guess at what the next evolution in zombies is going to be. And I have to say, I think it's going to be zombies who can wield guns. Mm. Historically, it's been very rare that zombies can use any kind of tool other than a rock or a club that they might happen to pick up. But I think we're so plagued right now by these epidemics of mass shootings that I would be really surprised if someone doesn't make a zombie narrative soon that's about zombies getting their hands on guns and just wielding mass destruction.
I'm thinking about the zombie popularity reaching a crescendo in the late 60s and early 70s and then dropping off in the 80s. So what was happening culturally that kept zombies in their graves at that time?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I have a satisfactory answer for you, except that I do think, I mean, there are ebbs and flows. A lot of people think it just has to do with trends in popularity, but I really go back to the fact that in the new millennium, it was undeniable that there was a resurgence. There was a zombie boom. And I think that once we had sort of bigger fish to fry as a society, it became less popular to dress up as zombies and go out into the public sphere. For example, I think that, you know, most recently, a lot of those same people who were dressing up as zombies in 2006 have been actually just going out in their regular clothes and protesting on the weekends. Or they've been, registering people to vote. They've been actually acting out politically, whereas the zombie is kind of this placeholder for me for political action. The zombie is an image that's most resonant when you feel unhappy, but there's not a darn thing you can do about it. So I think right now we're in a mode where obviously people aren't happy right now in this country for a variety of different reasons, but they're not feeling disempowered. They're feeling like there are steps that they can take. My personal prognostication is that if we end up feeling that democracy is no longer working, that our votes are really not being counted, that we really don't have a say in government, that the people we send to Washington to vote how we want to vote are just doing their own thing, I think we're going to see another zombie rise en masse.
So that's a jump, the idea that rather than people being like George Romero, living in this culture that is permeated with zombies and they just pick up the zombie thing, that they were actually dressing up as zombies as some form of protest?
I do. I think it was almost like a practice for a protest. It wasn't an active protest. It was sort of, I think I called it a dress rehearsal for protest. It was saying, you know, if we wanted to, we could organize, we could show up here at a specific time and place, and there would be thousands of us. So it wasn't a protest. It had no commentary. It had nothing actually to say, these zombie mobs. But nowadays, I feel like people do have things to say, and they're finding a variety of different ways to express themselves.
I wonder if on your trips to Haiti or reading those early accounts, those journals brought back from Haiti to the U.S. from soldiers, best scary story that you've heard in your studies?
I don't know if I have a best scary story. I think the most surprising story I have is that I was speaking with a practitioner of voodoo in Haiti, and he said that he had been contacted by NASA, that NASA wanted him to give him the secrets of zombification to use to develop hypersleep. And that sounds crazy, but if you actually think about what the zombie is scientifically, it makes a lot of sense. It was a series of different poisons. One poison to give the appearance of death, so that the family members would be tricked and bury them in their graves, and then another poison to keep them in sort of a drugged up, half alive, half dead state where they could only follow simple instructions. I personally think that it's only just arrogant to think that zombies aren't real. If Haitians are saying that this is a technology that they own and that they are capable scientifically of raising people from their graves, then I accept that.
Thank you so much, Sarah Juliet Lauro, for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Juliet Lauro is author of The Transatlantic Zombie, Slavery, Rebellion, and Living Death. She teaches hemispheric literature at the University of Tampa. This is a special Halloween episode of On Second Thought.